Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It's Thursday, February 6th. State lawmakers consider tougher penalties for illegal fireworks on the day a sixth person dies after a New Year's Eve explosion. President Donald Trump's hard line on immigration has advocates reaching out to help families caught up in the crackdown, what they want the community to know. Got eggs? We check with local egg producers in Maui County as egg shortages add up to higher prices for consumers. Why whales and toddlers have more in common than you think, and only the lonely on The Long View with Neil Milner. We consider isolation and the sexes. What's technology got to do with it? Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The death toll from the New Year's Eve mass casualty event is now at a half a dozen. The death of a 30-year-old woman yesterday who has yet to be identified came just as lawmakers debated proposed bills to crack down on illegal fireworks. HPR's Ashley Mizuo was at that hearing at the state capitol and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. So, of course, you know, the biggest bill going through the legislature regarding fireworks is Governor Josh Green's bill that would enhance penalties for illegal fireworks offenses that kill or maim people. But the biggest fix in this bill is changing the definition of, you know, an aerial device or consumer firework or fireworks, because currently, to prove that, you know, what was set off was actually categorized as an aerial device or firework or what, the definition of it currently in the statute is so vague that they need to bring in usually an expert to designate it as an explosive. And also what makes it difficult to do that is oftentimes by the time they're, you know, going through this, the evidence has been destroyed because, of course, the firework has been blown off. So here's Honolulu Police Department Narcotics Division Lieutenant Ernest Robello.
Definitions are killing us. From what I'm being told by attorneys, prosecutors, public defenders, attorneys in private practice is the definitions are very vague or they're too generic. And so what happens is when the burden of proof is on the state or the city, it becomes very challenging in court to proceed with prosecution of these cases. So many of these cases, even though we make an arrest or we say we issue a citation, they get dumped by the prosecutor's office for various reasons. I'm being told majority of them are for the purposes of the definitions.
This bill, you know, will also separate out the different types of fireworks offenses. Currently, they're all the same charge, whether, you know, you're blowing off a firework in the street or you're throwing an ignited one into a car, which are obviously two very different things. But now these would be separate offenses, including a $300 citation creation, which would allow, you know, police to give out these citations, which require a lower burden of proof. So instead of having to prove without a reasonable doubt that this person did in fact blow off the firework, which is why the evidence is so necessary, currently the citation would be able to allow the police to just have to prove that it's more likely than not that they did that crime, kind of like a traffic ticket. And it also creates a Class C felony for transporting illegal fireworks on airplanes, which is one thing that came out during one of the Senate hearings, that is one of the ways that, you know, fireworks, illegal fireworks, are getting into Hawaii is on these airplanes. But the Office of Public Defender is opposing this measure. The office's legislative liaison, Sonny Gannon, says it's because this bill would impose both civil and criminal trials at the same time for offenses, which could be considered unconstitutional.
In the criminal cases, you're going to be offered a public defender if you are an indigent client, like many people of Hawaii are. And in the civil cases, you are not. However, arising from the same facts and circumstances, this is going to create a real problem, likely be unconstitutional.
And so, you know, the issue, another issue with this bill that came out yesterday during the Senate hearing on it was some of the language doesn't provide a carve out for commercial fireworks to blow off fireworks in public beaches or on public parks. Here's Hawaii Explosives and Pyrotechnics Incorporated, COO Bruce Albert. Hawaii Explosives and Pyrotechnics puts on about 90% of Hawaii's fireworks shows, and they wanted to see an exemption written into this bill for them.
For those that want to try to display fireworks in those situations, then yeah, a permit should be required and it should go through a review process where the relevant agencies can weigh in and decide whether it's appropriate or not. That's a standard practice for most kinds of commercial activities, right? You want a process of review and you want people to weigh in on safety and nuisance issues. And we're all for that. We think that's highly appropriate. And so we just, that's what we're trying to do. We're just trying to get the language so that it does what they think it needs it to do. And we're still able to do what we want to do, which is to do fireworks shows for the public, for community events and all the other things that the fireworks shows are great for.
So they brought that up with the Attorney General yesterday and likely in further iterations of this bill, some type of carve out for them will be allowed, because also written into this bill are carve outs for, you know, like movie production, things like that. I think theatrical performances is like another carve out that allows this. So the commercial fireworks people who are, you know, putting on the key shows like the Waikiki show on Friday nights, say they want also obviously their own carve out too. Another bill lawmakers are considering would create a shipping container inspection program within the Department of Law Enforcement. The department would need to develop a program to randomly inspect shipping containers by October. The Department of Law Enforcement, you know, was a little concerned about the cost of the program and the amount of labor that would have to go into it. The legislature in this bill would be budgeting $700,000 for 2 years for the program. But, you know, they DLE said that two additional dogs that would be needed to do the inspections would cost $600,000 on its own, not including, you know, the extra labor that they would have to put into it and any type of other type of technology that they would need. It's also not clear how many containers the department would need to inspect because it just says randomly. And that is, there's about 250,000 containers that come into the state each year. And so it would just be up to the Department of Law Enforcement to kind of come up with the kind of specifics of this program. DLE Acting Director Mike Lambert said that if they were given adequate resources, that they would be happy to implement the program, but they think that the $700,000 is likely not going to be enough.
Did he say why the dogs would cost as much as they're saying?
I guess that's just the price of the dogs if you need to add on new ones. I think it's the training likely and the specificity of the types of like things you would need to do to prepare the dog to be able to do the sniffing on these items.
Seems high. But
Do say that it is possible if the dogs can sometimes smell from outside of the containers, some of them. And then also that even if the fireworks are like packed, you know, deep in the back of a shipping container and there's a bunch of furniture or something in the front, usually the dog would be able to smell, so they wouldn't necessarily have to unload the full container if they were able to like use these dogs. Senator Brandon Elefante says that it would be up to DLE to coordinate with the harbors how exactly the program would work.
They would have to coordinate with the different harbor group users, the shipping and cargo containers, on how that goes about. And so I think it's important that we continue the dialogue and collaborate with them so that we ensure that if we were to go forward with a shipping inspector or cargo inspection container program, that we do it in a way that doesn't impact logistics at our harbors.
And, you know, the Retail Merchants Association wrote a testimony in opposition to the measure because they were concerned about the delays in moving the containers for inspection to a secure location, which the bill does say would need to happen. There are another two measures that were both that would both ban fireworks completely in the state that the Senate was also considering yesterday. One would have a carve-out exception for cultural uses. One concern about that measure would be that what exactly would constitute a cultural use, because there are just so many different types of cultures and different types of uses, and so it would be hard to, you know, necessarily identify or define the word cultural use so specifically to make it an effective law that wouldn't be challenged in the courts.
Yeah, I mean, it's a dilemma. And then when you have, like, huge volumes of fireworks, like, you know, where are people storing it, right? Because we saw in the Aliumano Salt Lake incident where there were fireworks, boxes of fireworks in people's cars.
Right, right. And I think, too, one of the issues for DLE is once they confiscate fireworks, they do need to store them and dispose of them properly, which can be really, really expensive. And so they're talking about trying to possibly pass some of that cost on to the offender. But it's not exactly clear how feasible that would be, especially for like lower level offenses, because it is so expensive to dispose of these fireworks.
Right. And if they're stored somewhere, it's risky business, like we saw with those fatals several years back.
Right,
it's a difficult situation. But thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HBR's government reporter Ashley Mizuo, who will be tracking this hot button issue on fireworks for us this session.
It's been unseasonably warm in Moscow. Flowers blooming, birds chirping, people throwing off heavy winter layers. But outside the city, in the country's far north, melting ice is causing problems. That story and more global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
On the next Fresh Air, writer and dominatrix Brittany Newell joins us to talk about her new novel, Softcore. It explores the underworld of San Francisco's dive bars, strip clubs, and BDSM dungeons, where tech bros, executives, and outcasts live out their fantasies. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Immigration advocates in Hawaii are working to keep up with the latest Republican crackdown on those who are in this country illegally. Changes within ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, stand to affect millions of immigrants across the country, including here in Hawaii. D.W. Gibson is the newest addition to the conversation team. He sat down with Sandy Ma, community and policy advocate for the Legal Clinic, and Liza Ryan Gill, executive director of the Hawaii Coalition for Immigrant Rights. Gill recently spoke with each of the state's chiefs of police about ICE's efforts to engage local law enforcement on immigration arrests. She was told there had been no coordination with federal agents. That's in stark contrast with several states that already have cooperative agreements in place with ICE.
Sandy, you know, one question I have is about mixed status families, especially when a particular family has been in state for a few generations. You might have grandparents or parents that might not necessarily have documentation, but younger generations that do. What information are you trying to get to these households in terms of preparations they can make, getting documents in line? What kind of advice do you have for mixed status families?
So we are holding the Legal Clinic along with other organizations, along with Liza's organization, Hawaii Coalition for Immigrants' Rights, the ACLU, Pacific Gateway Center. We are holding a lot of Know Your Rights training sessions to advise people on what they should do if ICE comes to their home, to their place of work, if they're stopped in a traffic stop, so people can know how to respond. First of all, stay calm. Everyone needs to stay calm. Do not run. There's different ways to respond in different scenarios. We want to stress that there is a lot of misinformation and disinformation. To please verify very carefully things that you see online, to please confirm that information before spreading misinformation and disinformation. I know that is very hard to do. We are all in a heightened state of stress, but to please try to confirm before spreading any misinformation and disinformation.
And Liza, I know, you know, there are a lot of community members that may not be directly affected by the law enforcement actions, but might still be forced to confront them in one way or another. I'm thinking of teachers and schools, hospital workers, religious leaders at churches. What's important for these individuals to understand in terms of their rights and responsibilities and what can legally be expected of them from law enforcement?
Well, right now we're working with the Attorney General's office to create the guidance for these public spaces. The Trump administration rescinded the sensitive locations memo, meaning previously, since 2011, it was the Department of Homeland Security's, ICE's own internal protocols that they would not conduct operations in places of worship, in healthcare settings, at weddings or funerals, or in education settings in schools. Obviously, it's very, very upsetting to see this memo be rescinded and kind of all of these different places be on the table for potential action. Teachers, especially, and healthcare workers, their primary concern are their students and their patients, and they want people to be safe. They want their families to be safe. They want their students to feel secure when they are in a school setting. And we did recently have a rumor of an ICE action here at Washington Middle and Kamiki Middle School. We were able to speak with a senior official at Department of Homeland Security who verified that this action did not occur. We don't have the full information as to what might have happened. And I think obviously folks are really anxious, and so they may see another type of federal agent on a school ground or near a school ground and be very concerned for some of their students. And so they put that information out there. We would ask that you go to on social media or on Instagram, we're at, you know, Hawaii Coalition for Immigrant Rights. We will do our best to post in these sensitive locations. We're not necessarily going to track down and verify every report of ICE actions, but if there is a report of an action in a healthcare setting or in an educational setting, please check with us. We will do our best to communicate with senior officials at Department of Homeland Security to verify whether or not this indeed occurred. This is something we saw during the first Trump administration, right? There was a lot of trauma on our elementary and middle school students. We also saw an explosion of internal racism, telling young kids that were whose maybe English was not their first language, that they needed to leave, that this place was not for them. That's not what we need right now. And again, nothing is going to stop the federal government from doing their actions. We hope and pray that they don't decide to go to an elementary school. I think there's a lot better ways for them to be able to do their job. But in that case, the Attorney General's office is developing that guidance. And we know that we have the support of the superintendent to make sure that all administrative staff and teachers within Hawaii know what their rights are and know what they should do if a federal agent comes onto their school campus.
And we also have the support of our elected officials. They are very aware of what is happening in our state and are concerned and want our sensitive areas to have the proper protections. And so people should also share any concerns that they may have with their elected officials to ensure that their concerns are properly registered.
And some of that guidance, you know, is still in the making, as you indicated, Liza. But Sandy, what should a teacher or hospital worker do as of now if they get information, they don't know if it's reliable information, what should they do with that information?
So teachers should report it to their principal, their vice principal, to let them know that this is happening in their schools, because teachers are not responsible for verifying this information and for their overall safety of the entire school as a whole. So teachers should be reporting this to the vice principal, to the principal, so that documentation occurs, so that the principals can understand what is happening on the ground in each classroom, and so that we can have verifiable information that there are these rumors, if they turn out not to be true, and so that we could have proper guidance prepared so that we know which school this is happening at, how often it's happening, whether it's elementary, middle, or high school. And so this helps in preparing guidance.
I know you've both been tracking some bills in the legislature that pertain to law enforcement actions around immigration. If I could maybe put you on the spot to sort of single out one that you think could have the most impact, the most important place for lawmakers to put their energies right now?
I think that would be HB 457. That relates to law enforcement immigration access to detained individuals and due process, right? So anybody who has watched a cop drama or something knows what it that they have the right to remain silent and these when you're Mirandized. And so essentially, we call this our Miranda Plus bill. As a coalition, we have supported language access as a federal right under the Civil Rights Act for many sessions. And this is an extension of our work on language access. So if you are detained by local law enforcement and Immigration and Customs Enforcement comes to the jail and they want to interview you, you have the right to decline that interview. And so what we have asked, and we've had conversations with the chiefs on this issue and they're supportive. They had some good comments about how it might be practical to do this, but simply just to let that individual know in a language that they can understand what their rights are.
I just want to make sure that everyone who's listening to this program understands when you are are in this country, whether you have papers or not, you have constitutional rights. And I think people don't always understand that or know that. When you are in this country, the Constitution does not ask whether you have the correct papers or not. This bill, HB 457, is critically important because when you are in custody and ICE is asking local law enforcement if they could speak with you, you should know that you have a right, a constitutional right, not to talk with ICE or to talk with ICE with your attorney present. That is your constitutional right, and that right does not go away just because you may not have the right type of papers.
I think that's where the unalienable part comes in, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, anything else to both of you, Liza first, that I haven't asked you about yet that you just feel is really important and paramount and you'd want listeners to hear?
Well, I'll make a shameless plug to follow organizations like Pacific Gateway Center, Roots Reborn on Maui, Aloha Latinos on Hawaii Island, here, Hawaii Coalition for Immigrant Rights, the Legal Clinic here on Oahu as well. Amazing organizations that are doing the work both to make sure that folks can have access to legal representation. And I think that's something for people to remember as well, is that immigration is a civil matter. When they say that you have the right to have an attorney present, you have the right to have an attorney in immigration court, but one will not be provided to you. And so it's really important that if folks are worried about their status, if they currently have status, but they're worried that this federal government may take that status away, make a family plan about what you will do. Know what that number is that you are going to call first to make sure that you can probably get representation for you through that court proceeding. I think many of us remember those horrifying stories under the first Trump administration when you had small children in immigration court who probably did not speak hardly any English at all, 6 and 7 years old, standing in front of an immigration court judge against an ICE prosecutor. There's no way that that child is going to be able to defend themselves on their legal rights, maybe a claim for asylum. There are many folks that have a pathway for a legal status, and they haven't been able to pursue that for lots of different family reasons and or because of the cost. So if we can make sure that people know what their plan is, and also that when we think about this situation of either folks having status or not having status, folks tend to believe that this is a black and white issue. It is not. It is a spectrum of gray. There are so many different types of status. And as we have seen, even over the last week, you can have a pathway and a type of status, and it can be removed from you. Immigration is exceedingly complex. And when we can stand with folks and believe in our Constitution that people have the right to fight their case, many times those individuals end up winning and they get to stay and keep their family whole. And that is what our Constitution can provide someone. And we need to remember in this state, they may be saying something in D.C., but we still have rights here.
That was Liza Ryan Gill from the Hawaii Coalition for Immigrant Rights and Sandy Ma from the Legal Clinic talking to the Conversation's D.W. Gibson. They were discussing how the Trump administration's deportation orders are affecting immigrants and the people who serve them. The bill they mention, HB 457, which calls for civil rights protections, is advancing in the legislature and awaits a full floor vote.
Sometimes estranged parents go to court to force their children to learn to love them. It's called reunification therapy.
It isn't okay for somebody to continuously hurt you mentally, physically, emotionally, and then you forgive them. That is not okay. And we should not be training kids to think that way.
Do estranged parents have the legal right to be loved by their children? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily, Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30, here on HPR One.
In some markets, there are empty shelves, and in restaurants, there are surcharges where they're skipping eggs altogether. Think bulgogi, but without the egg. HPR reporter Catherine Kluwa-Pachtel joins us with the snapshot on egg production and prices in Maui County. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
So what are you hearing out in the field?
Well, so as we know, all of this is being caused by avian influenza or bird flu on the continental U.S., and it's wiping out millions of chickens there, either from the disease directly or from culling if one sick bird is found. And so mainland egg supplies, as we know, in Hawaii are really slim in the stores. As you mentioned, you know, a lot of places don't have any eggs at all. And there are some larger local farms in Hawaii that are trying to fill the gaps in the shelves. But what we're seeing is many residents are turning to local farmers to get their eggs directly from the farm. So most small farmers producing eggs aren't going to sell them in the stores because there's additional Department of Health requirements, like you need a certified kitchen to wash and package those eggs. But across Maui County, farmers I talked with say they've had a huge increase in demand from people just reaching out to them and trying to get any eggs that they have available. Raven Kaufman Lujan is a small farmer on Maui that produces 2 to 3 dozen eggs a day. So that might not sound like a lot, but she says she's been completely overwhelmed with requests.
I have a wait list. I think now it's close to like 300 people that are wanting eggs, and it grows every single day. There's someone new reaching out wanting eggs from me. It's crazy. Before I had like a few regular customers and some kind of like once a month, every couple weeks kind of customers. But now the demand is pretty crazy. So many people realizing that there's no eggs at the store. And so they're looking to buy eggs anywhere that they can get eggs from.
And so she's really what, just a backyard farmer?
She is. She has, you know, some other livestock and produce that she offers locally in her community. And across the state, you know, we've seen prices in the stores for eggs skyrocket. And like you mentioned, many shelves are empty altogether. There's limits on how many cartons of eggs per customer. Cameron Hero is a homestead farmer on Molokai. He has about 250 hens, which translates to about 10 to 15 dozen eggs a day.
Our market is basically family and friends. You know, people find out that we're selling eggs and they want to buy, and so we provide for them. Like I said, in the last several weeks, you know, because of all that was going on, we just noticed like, oh my goodness, you know, there's nothing in the refrigerator to sell. We're kind of like about a week's out of people reserving. And so when people ask for eggs and you have 3 or 4 dozen today, I say, sorry, limited supply. We won't have until then. I give them the day. And so far we've been able to accommodate, I don't know, maybe 80% of those asking us. The other 20, yeah, I mean, we can't for now anyway. Yeah. You know, I always have this grand idea of doing things. So I told my wife, you know, let's do an egg stand to kind of help increase our sales of eggs. So I got the egg stand all situated, and I think in the first several days I had to close it because it started getting busy. I didn't know about, you know, the shortage of eggs. And so, yeah, just recently we noticed the egg demand has increased a lot.
Yeah, you know, we always hear this, buy local, and this is, you know, a good reason. You help the farmers, and, you know, the eggs are fresher, right?
Absolutely. And so one of the questions I asked the local farmers that I spoke with across Maui County was, after all of this dies down, you know, after avian flu is sort of passed over us and under control, do you think that people will keep buying local? As you said, you know, that's a message that we hear a lot. And here's Raven Kaufman Lujan on Maui again, talking about the benefits of local eggs.
When you get an egg from the grocery store, it's already 45 to 60 days old. That's really old. Opposed to one, like if you're buying a carton of eggs for me, they were probably all laid yesterday or the day before or within the week. They're just a lot fresher. They're better quality, I would say. You can taste the difference for sure, a store-bought egg to a farm fresh egg. So I think a lot of people, once they try the fresh eggs and realize how much better they are, and then also realizing like, oh shoot, I can't always even get eggs at the grocery store, I think a lot of people are going to stick to local. There's always going to be some that don't because maybe they can't afford it. That's a big part of it too. Maui's an expensive place to live. It's hard to survive. But I think people that can afford to buy fresh eggs after tasting them will probably stick with the fresh local eggs.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, just recently that Costco had an issue with, I think, salmonella in their eggs. And so, you know, that may have pushed people to look at the local eggs, you know, and they tried it, they liked it, and we'll see if that sticks.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, all the farmers I spoke with acknowledge that some people will go back to buying Costco eggs, you know, just because they're on a limited budget, but they hope that people will continue to support local. Farmers I talked with say, as far as pricing, they're really trying to keep their prices steady. You know, some folks said that, you know, feed has increased in cost for them a little bit lately, and so they had maybe had a slight increase in price before the egg shortage. But all of the local farmers say, you know, they're wanting to encourage people to buy local. So they're trying not to really jump their prices the way we've seen in the stores. Corey Harris of Simple Roots Farm on Maui says they've been getting 20 to 30 calls or texts or emails a day asking for eggs. They have a little bit larger farm, and so they have, you know, a supply to share. But he said they've noticed a huge demand from bakeries and restaurants, particularly. You know, as you mentioned, they're having a really tough time keeping their menu with egg items. And, you know, he said even though he has, you know, a good supply, he said he had never had a shortage with his customers before. He said, you know, he's trying to keep it fair for everybody with a shortage, and he can't supply, you know, 40 to 50 dozen a day to a single customer the way, you know, restaurants and bakeries are asking for. But Harris wanted to share a reminder for people.
I'd emphasize to people that, you know, even when the Costco eggs come back, remember who was there for you when you didn't have the Costco eggs. You know, support those people. There's a lot of farms out there that are wanting to do eggs, and they want to grow, but the demand has to be there too. So it's like, it's not a cheap venture to get into. The turnaround time for a hen is, you know, 5 to 6 months. And when you're talking about hundreds of birds that you have to feed for 5 to 6 months before you see any money come in, is a big investment. So just to understand that all the farmers out there are working hard and support them even when the times are good.
Yes, you know, you've got to, like I said, support our local farmers.
Yeah, and Harris talked about that turnaround time. You know, he mentioned 5 to 6 months, and that's to grow from a chick to a hen that's of laying age to start producing eggs. And, you know, you can't just create more eggs instantly. And so that's part of what we're seeing, this kind of lag in production, you know, in mainland farms building up their flocks again, and a trickle down to here in Hawaii. And same goes for local farmers. You know, they've seen a huge increase. They can't just instantly start producing more eggs. And so some of the farmers I talked with, you know, said they already had plans to increase their flocks before the shortage, but, you know, they are hesitant to make that huge jump because, as Harris mentioned, it is a big investment. And if people, you know, just go back to buying Costco eggs after avian flu is no longer a big issue, you know, farmers would be left with a big loss or a ton of extra eggs that they maybe might not necessarily be able to sell. So a lot to weigh right now, but it's great to see that, you know, folks are turning to local farmers, and hopefully that demand will continue.
Yes, and our hearts go out to those bakers out there, because, you know, I remember seeing a sign where the bakery was apologizing because they couldn't offer products because they had no eggs. And it's like, oh, it's not your fault, you know. But yeah, your heart goes out to folks during this time. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel about the situation with egg producers there in Maui and Molokai. We'll have more for you coming up right after a break. Well, there's breaking news in the whale world. Scientists discovered that humpback whale songs and human speech have striking similarities. Consider this: whales may learn new songs in the same way that babies learn to speak. Ellen Garland is a whale biologist at the University of St. Andrews. She spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about what this new discovery means for whales and people.
Oh. So it is only the males that sing. The females, the males, the calves, the juveniles, they can all make the same sound types, but it's only the males that put it together in this big, long, complex sequential display, which they're learning from each other. Within each population, those males are singing the same song and it's constantly changing. They're learning from each other. But in the Southern Hemisphere, and particularly in the South Pacific, we have another phenomenon where a song will turn up from a neighboring population. It takes over. They throw their current song out the window and they suddenly learn this completely novel new song. And we call these song revolutions because it's really rapid and all of them do this really, really quickly. So they suddenly are singing this brand new song type. And we found that it spreads from the east coast of Australia all the way across to French Polynesia. And we've just been tracking this for now almost 2 decades. And recently we found it goes all the way to the west coast of South America, into Ecuador. So it can transmit across the entire ocean basin. Half the Southern Hemisphere, half the globe is vocally connected in these big novel song network. And the culture at this scale with these rapid and population-wide changes at this vast scale and this huge, this really fast pace doesn't happen in any other animal in the animal kingdom except for humans. So this, it has big analogies with human culture. So fashions, new fashion trends come in, or pop songs, because everyone loves a good pop song that comes in and it just takes over the charts. So these big sweeping changes, the best animal for us to compare to is humans. So I'm always interested in what this would mean to the whales themselves. So our first sort of hints about linguistic structure and why this might be interesting was a previous study I did where we managed to record whales in the process of changing their song during a revolution. So they sung old and new song together. So what we found with what we call hybrid songs is they'll sing the old song themes and then suddenly they'll put in a new song theme. But which one they choose and where they put it was really structured. So they find the highest point of structural similarity. So they find the sound types in the old song and the sound types in the new song, they're the most similar, and they can create a bridge between those two. So they'll sing the oldest one and they'll be singing along and then they'll find some similar sound types that are typical in each, and then they'll transition straight into that new theme and then sing the next theme and the next theme in the new song in the correct order. So it's these points where they have this structural similarity. So they basically took an entire theme out of the new song and popped it in the old song. So it's just like a whole section just went in. And it was really amazing that they'd do this. But this kind of chunking, this kind of segmentation is how birds learn their song and also sometimes how infants discover language. So it was the first hint that sometimes these statistical properties might actually be important. So from there, we then jumped into this study. So this new study was an amazing collaboration between developmental psychologists, linguists, and us whale biologists. But this came about because we were at a workshop together and I happened to see our developmental psychologist, Imbal, present her work on how infants discover words and language. And I looked at it and went, oh, that makes sense to me. Well, that makes sense to me because I think I might see something similar in whales. And then I presented and she had the same reaction. And then we also had our evolution linguist, Simon, who designs these amazing models for how languages change through time. And between the three of us, we sat down and we were like, okay, I think, you know, there's something going on here. So what we did is we use methods that were developed to understand how babies discover words and speech, and we applied them to whale songs recorded from New Caledonia in the South Pacific. And really to our surprise, because this is quite surprising, it showed the same statistical structure that is found in every human language. So I'm always really clear that humpback whale song is absolutely not a language because it lacks that semantic meaning. It doesn't have that semantic structure in it, but it does have these statistical properties which are shared between whales and humans. So we think, or we're suggesting, that this really points to one of the commonalities between the two species, which is culture. And they both are very socially learned, culturally transmitted displays. So it would suggest that these aspects of language structure and whale song arise because these behaviours are learned and are transmitted over generations. So it's actually easier to learn these long sequences, all of these really long displays. It's actually easier if you have some of these statistical properties. They actually aid in learning. So these help the whales and help humans learn language. So I think this is really kind of exciting that it's telling us that there is these really important structures in whale song that may aid them in learning. I'm really, really fascinated and interested into what the function of humpback whale song, but also how are they learning these, especially with these big song revolutions and they have to change their songs so rapidly. Like, how on earth are you learning a brand new 5-minute display so rapidly on that breeding season? Right? That's a hard thing to do. So having these kind of structures and abilities, these really deep underlying properties to aid in that is kind of fascinating. I think it really opens a door, but it also is a really excellent, really cool method for non-human communication that we can start looking in other culturally transmitted vocal systems. So birdsong, you know, a lot of birdsong that is socially learned and culturally transmitted. So it would be amazing to start looking there. And of course, it means that these aspects which were once thought to be unique to humans are not. They're actually shared. So thinking about what unites us across the animal kingdom and also including humans in that animal kingdom is really interesting to think about how these big, complex communication systems actually evolved through time and what they're for.
Well, that was whale biologist Ellen Garland from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland talking to HBR's Maddie Bender. Her team's research was published this morning in the journal Science. We'll have a link to it on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Worker productivity in this economy is booming.
So you're down to sort of 3 or 4 folks on a line, maybe a little bit more, depends on how big the line is, where before you might have had, you know, 10, 12 humans doing that kind of work.
I'm Kai Rizdal. How we are doing more with less, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
On the next Living on Earth? So far, avian flu hasn't been seen spreading from human to human. But if it does, it'll be very bad news.
We've been looking at influenza viruses for many decades here at St. Jude, and this is the nastiest virus that we've dealt with.
I'm Ainsley O'Neill, the growing specter of another pandemic. Next time on Living on Earth from PRX.
Beginning this evening at 7.
This is for all the lonely people. That's a line from one of the countless songs written about being lonely. And I would be lonely if it wasn't for our contributing editor, Neil Milner, who joins me in studio this morning.
You expect too much. Actually, the whale song, the last whale song you heard, they sang my segment. So I don't have much to say that they didn't say already. Well, yes, lonely. This segment is... it's about solitude more than loneliness, and I'll tell you why. It's based on mainly on a piece in the recent Atlantic by Derek Thompson called The Antisocial Generation, that is antisocial century, that we're essentially become people who revel in solitude at the expense of all kinds of former collective activities that we always thought were natural and helpful. People eat out less with friends and bring food in more. They hang out with friends a lot less. They don't entertain as much. They spend a lot more time with their kids and a lot less time with anybody else. Their leisure has become privatized. The computers, social media, even things like working out is a lot different than playing basketball. Kids don't see other kids as much as they used to. So you really have a generation that has the people that have started to pull themselves in, to withdraw into themselves. They have more leisure than they used to. That leisure tends to be used for watching television. So it's really quite different. It's a difference that I felt and in some ways I've lived. And along with this study, there's a couple of other things that are listed on, I think will be listed on the website, about less hanging out than there used to be, about how people spend less time and walk faster through public space than they used to, and a little bit about the difference between men and women. But all in all, it's really quite different and quite profound. It's happened for a lot of different reasons. Some started long ago, suburbanization and so on. Others have been around for a while, and we've talked about it. Robert Putnam's book about bowling alone, how people have become much less likely to join team sports and to have time with others outside, much less community participation. Some of them are a little bit newer, like social media, like parents changing expectations. The expectations for parents now is much more child-centered than it used to be. So you really have some very important changes that Thompson says, among other people say it also, that are profoundly affecting people in the United States in very harmful ways.
And then I was reading some of those articles, you know, and the differences between males and females. You know, women are more apt to talk, men kind of, they don't.
No, they don't. Yeah.
Or they talk about different things.
They tend to be a little more solitary. But the other interesting thing in that finding is that even women think it's more important for women to hang out than it is for men. Men can get along. I think the notion is men don't need it. They're kind of clueless individuals, tough, solitary folks.
Macho.
It turns out, as Reeves points out in the study, that simply isn't the case, that men are much more isolated and with very serious medical and economic effects. They're just cut off from all kinds of social life in ways that are more profound than are women. And the notion that they don't need this other kind of attention, this other kind of solidarity, the other kind of connection is simply not the case. So, you know, you can look at these general findings, you can look at the very complicated set of long-term and short-term things that have brought that out. And also the other important thing is to look at, well, what precisely are the harmful effects of these sorts of things? Some of them are what you might call psychological, that when people withdraw, they learn less about how to behave with others. As he points out, psychological studies of kids have always shown kids' brains, a human brain takes a long time to develop, much longer than other animals. And part of the process of its physical development depends upon the information that it learns from others. And in a sense, so it isn't just being social. There's a link between the neurological and the social. And I think that some of the evidence about the difficulties that have arisen since social media probably reflects something like that.
Well, you know, I recall taking sign language classes, and the teachers, and this was like, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and the teachers were lamenting with cell phones, their students were texting as opposed to signing, and there was that less face-to-face.
Yes,
you know, in a marginalized community already, and so they were very concerned about that.
Well, give yourself a little self-test. If you're in a social situation, a coffee shop or anything else like that, not necessarily close face-to-face with loved ones, think about how often when you have that little bit of space waiting in line, let's say at Costco or whatever, you pull out the phone to check stuff. And I've made it a point myself to try to discipline myself away from that. I think it looks cheesy, but also I was once at a restaurant and Jim Nabors was there with seven or eight other people. So Jim Nabors, I mean, he was a great entertainer and he was a great talker. So there are eight people at the table and he's sitting there. He's talking to one other, and the other ones are all using their phones to check. So, but there are a couple of other important possible harmful effects. One let's call social, and that has to do with something I've talked about before on here, which is the importance of a social infrastructure to a safe, productive neighborhood. That is, neighborhoods that seem to work the best, that protect each other best, let's say, in natural disasters, tend to be neighborhoods in which people know each other and talk to each other and have places where they gather. They don't have to be good friends, but they're not necessarily relatives. And one of the things that one of the social infrastructure writers says is that we build less places. Now, government builds less places like that, fewer libraries and so on. So, and that's an important factor. The last one he talks about is political. And he said, what you have to understand about the possible political effects of this solitariness, this lack of willingness to join and to interact with others, is what you call the middle ring. He said, family is for love. A tribe is for attachment. A middle ring is these people in between that you don't know very well. You get the example he gives, and I'll do it quickly. The example he gives is two women at a school board meeting. They don't know each other really very well. They know that they disagree on some important factors. They get put on a similar committee. They discover that they differ, but they can do this joint work together, and that creates a certain level of tolerance, a certain level of everyday empathy. It doesn't necessarily change minds. It creates a kind of productive civility and a kind of tolerance that's not just for politeness purposes, but because it makes a society work better.
Yeah, those connections are really
the connections
important.
Are there. So this stuff to me is really interesting because of the tentacles and the way it reaches out.
Yeah, well, we have to, like I said, exert some discipline, right? Whether you've got your hand.
Oh,
your
yeah. If you start becoming self-conscious about it, I've discovered what some other people have, which is I don't read the same way anymore. So much of my reading is to look around for a lot of stuff, find it so that I can present it in some ways. I find myself having less patience with complicated. I'm starting to sound like my students were. God, how awful would that be? So, yeah. So try to behave yourself better.
Okay. Yeah, it's scary when I hear people listen to podcasts and they put it on, 1.5 times speed.
Oh, really?
It's a whole new world.
Well, and he said, I should end with this. He said, look, this is Thompson. I've got kids. I know that solitude is important and I want solitude. And that's, it's not just the poets who talk about that, but there's a limit.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Neil.
Sure.
If you're ever lonely, give me a call. We'll have a conversation.
I have a website that I can.
We've been hearing from our contributing editor, Neil Milner, and we'll have links to the articles he referenced on our website later today. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we'll be revisiting some of our favorite stories about seagoing vessels and the people that man them. We'll be talking shipwrecks, underwater robots, and more. Got feedback for us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.